This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Ladies and gentlemen, the well-known peculiarity of the word that is used to describe the departure of Bnei Yisrael from the shores of the Red Sea after the destruction of the Egyptian people is Vayasa Moshe Es Yisrael Miyamsuf. Unlike all other points from which they departed throughout their 40 years of sojourn, this particular one does not use the kal form, vayisu, the ordinary form of the verb, they traveled on, they departed, but it uses a hifil form, a causative form, vayasa Moshe es Yisrael miyamsuf. Moshe caused the Bnei Yisrael to move from Yamsuf. He actually had to move them from the edges of Yamsuf. And Rashi and Chazal say, Hey Sion Baal Korcho. He had to force them to leave. Sheotru Mitzrayim Suseim Betachshite Zoho Vechesev Avonim Toivis. Because the Egyptians used to decorate their horses with gold and silver and precious stones. Vohoyu Yisrael Moitzin Oysom Bayom. And the Jews were picking up these precious things on the sea. Ugedoylo Hoyso Bizas Hayom Mibizas Mitzrayim. And the spoils at the side of the sea were far, far greater than the spoils in Egypt itself. As we know, before they left Egypt, they had to go and request all sorts of things. They had to request payment for their decades and decades of service to the Egyptians. And they were given a lot of material, they were given a lot of wealth when they left Egypt. But Chazal tell us that the wealth that they collected at the edges of the sea far outweighed anything that they were able to collect from the Mitzrayim themselves, from the Egyptians themselves. And they were busy collecting, they couldn't pull themselves away. They were collecting not just because they wanted the money, but because they knew that was also the Ratzon Hashem. Hashem wanted them to go out of Egypt wealthy. That was part of the original promise to Avraham, V'achar ken yetzu b'rechush gadol. And afterwards they will go out with tremendous property. They will come out enriched, materially enriched from their period in Mitzrayim. That was part of the original promise. And we know that their attitude was that they wouldn't like it to be said of the Ribono Shel Olam that the first part of the promise he kept, that they'll go and they'll be enslaved in Egypt for 400 years, that Hashem was meticulous about observing. The second part, the latter part, that they'll leave Egypt with a great deal of wealth, that Hashem was not that careful about observing. That we didn't want, that would have been a Chilul Hashem. So they saw it as part of their godly mission, as part of what they needed to do for themselves in order to get out of Mitzrayim, was the collection of whatever wealth was available. And that wealth was absolutely hefker. There it was, lying on the beach, lying on the sea, with nobody to take it. It didn't belong to anybody at all. It's not so easy to pull yourself away when you believe that halachically it's yours, that the Ribono Shel Olam wants you to have it, and it's all there for the taking. They didn't want to leave. Moshe had to pull them away. That pulling away was in itself an important lesson. Why did he have to pull them away? So leave them a little longer. What will be? There's plenty of gold and silver. It didn't do anybody any harm to get wealthy. And certainly when it's not at the expense of anybody else. And it would be been the quickest way and the easiest way to establish enormous reserves of wealth for the Jewish people. Surely nationally, apart from individually, also nationally, it made a great deal of sense to let them stay an extra few days and let them take whatever money they could get, let them pick up whatever gold and silver they could get, and then they would go on their way. What would be lost? What would be lost is they would get to Har Sinai a few days later. That's what would be lost. They would arrive at Mount Sinai a few days later, which would mean a few days extra without the Torah. That's all. And that Moshe wasn't prepared to risk. That the Bnei Yisrael should be without the Torah for a few days extra, that he wasn't prepared to risk. And so he teaches us here, he teaches Am Yisrael a principle and a midah, a characteristic which we're meant to imbibe and contain within ourselves throughout our history. And that is the ability to leave things behind. Which is one of the hardest things to do in life. To leave things behind. One doesn't have to get the last bit of everything out of everything. Because in doing that, sometimes in emphasizing, drawing the last bit of nourishment out of whatever one can, that's all very good. One is able to draw more out of the past. But sometimes one sacrifices the future for that. And walking this balancing line of knowing when it's time to say goodbye to the past and to open oneself to a new future, that's one of the hardest things that there is. Because the past is secure and the future is unknown. What we know for sure is there's all the gold and silver. It's there for the taking. We know that for sure. We know its value. We know it's easy to achieve. There's no problem with that. There's no difficulty with that. We feel safe. We feel secure. We're in territory that we understand and that we know. To leave that aside and to walk off into a future where you don't know what that future holds, that's where it becomes hard. I'll give you an example of how hard it is. If I said to you, there's going to be a wonderful shiur tomorrow, and it starts at 6 o'clock, and it's the beginning of a whole series of shiurim, and this series you're going to have to pay R1,000 for. Wonderful series, you're going to go away with incredible concepts and knowledge and so on. And it's not available anywhere else. I can imagine a lot of people would be willing to pay R1,000 for Torah. But yet, if there was no fee for that shiur, and come 6 o'clock, or 5:45, and you're busy with a deal, and to leave the deal then, you would have to lose R1,000 to make the shiur. Very hard to do it. To pay out R1,000 is relatively easy. To forego, to leave R1,000 lying on the ground in order to make it to a shiur, that goes against the grain, that goes against human nature. It's an amazing thing. It's the same. Economically, it's the same. But we find it almost impossible to leave behind something which is there for the taking. Can't do it. Find it very difficult to do. When something's available, not to take it up, to leave it. When one's offered something, you have people who are on diet, and they can manage, they won't go into a shop and buy a bar of chocolate, and they're good, they're very good. But when somebody offers them one, and it's there on a plate, and everybody else is having, it's so hard to leave it on the plate. Leave it there, you don't have to have it, leave it where it is. It goes against human nature to turn down an offer. When one is given something for nothing, to turn it down. The only mechanism we know to use to turn things down is to ask ourselves, what does it cost? Then we figure out whether to turn it down or not. And we're actually quite well trained in exaggerating the cost and minimizing the benefits. So when there's a cost involved, we're quite good at turning things down. But when there's no cost involved, it's for nothing. It doesn't cost you a thing. There it is. To say no thanks. Don't need it. Very hard. Particularly when I say, and why not? What does it bother you? So if it's a chocolate, you can say, why not? Because I'm going to put on a kilo. That's why. Not worth it. So there's a cost involved. But if I say to you, because it's a bit of extra time before you get to Har Sinai. You don't know what Har Sinai is. You don't know what it's going to be. You don't know if you're ever going to get there. The whole thing's uncertain. To give up something definite for something vague, and the future is vague. And we don't like giving up the past for the future because we don't like giving up something secure and definite for something which is vague and ill-defined. And that differentiates between the achievers and the non-achievers. The non-achievers hug the past. They love that security. They can't pull themselves away from it. They're not willing to risk. And the achievers are willing to say, enough of the past, let's look what the future has to offer. Maybe yes, maybe no, but if we don't move, we'll never get there. And they have the ability to leave the past behind and wander off into an insecure future. Of course, then you get the unstable people. The unstable people go even further. They're always wandering off into insecure futures. They don't even have a present. That's a different kind of a sickness, but we're not talking about them. We're talking about the two more normal types, the type who hugs the past and the type who moves into the future. And what does one need in order to be able to do that? What midah does one need? One has to be able to visualize the future. You can't move off into something uncertain. It's not possible. An achiever doesn't leave the past. That's the definition of the difference between the achiever and the wandering gypsy, the hippie who just goes off from one new thing to another and is always wandering in search of this new experience which he never really finds. The difference is that the achiever leaves behind a past for a future which he visualizes. Nobody else can visualize it, but he does. That's called vision. When he goes off and he starts something on his own and he gets it going, he has a concept in his mind. He has a vision in his mind. He can see something. It's not a vague thing that might or might not work. It's not a theory. It's not a plan. It's a finished product that he can see ahead of him. And that's what he works towards. Being able to see that in certainty, being able to visualize that fully, enables him to leave behind the past, because the past and the future are then equally secure. He knows where he's going. And if Bnei Yisrael were able to visualize what it was, that doesn't need bitochen. Bitochen is the person who steps out and he's got nothing. So what is his bitochen? What does bitochen mean? We gave the difference last night between emunah and bitochen. I once gave the example which I think illustrates it with the greatest deal of clarity. If I say to you, I want to show you some plans, and I show you plans of a flimsy structure with wings and a sort of a fan in the front and canvas, and also very, very flimsy. And I say, this can fly, this is an aeronautical vehicle. It can take off and it can fly. Can't fly very fast, can't fly very far, it's not very stable, but it can fly. And I want to prove to you that it can fly. And I go through all the calculations and I show you the reports of the aeronautical engineers, it's all on paper. I show you that it can fly. And I say to you, do you believe me that it can fly? I say, yes, believe you, I have no questions. I say, good, now come with me out to the Rand Airport. I want to show you the model. Fine. We go out to Rand Airport and there's the model. And it looks even flimsier than you actually pictured it. It's a mess of pieces of wood sticking all over the place. A real flimsy thing. And I say, right, sit in it. I'm going to start the engine and you'll fly. You'll land and it's very easy. 1 second. No, thank you. You go. And I say, but you said you believe me that it flies. What's your answer? Emuna, yes. Bitochen, no. That's called belief without trust. Bitochen is when you're willing to lean on your belief, when you're willing to live by it. Emuna is an intellectual knowledge. And I said, does that mean that you don't believe me? You say, I do believe you. So if you believe me, why don't you get in? There's a difference between Emuna and Bitochen. There's a difference. Emuna is, if you stopped any of Am Yisrael and you said to them, do you think you'll be any the poorer if you leave this gold behind and you go to Har Sinai instead? They would have said, no, we don't believe we'll be any the poorer. That's Emuna. Bitochen is then, no, so leave it and go. That's Bitochen. And that's why the Chazal tell us that the Midrash Tanchuma says on Asedra, Mikano Yorabi Shimim and Yoshua Imer, Loi Nisno HaToiro Lidroish Ela Loichle Hamon. The Torah was given to be darshan, the Torah was given to be learned creatively. Lidroish doesn't mean just to learn. Lidroish means to darshan the Torah, to learn creatively in the Torah. Who was given that possibility, that opportunity? Ela Loichle Hamon. To the people who ate the mon, because they were in a very special situation of bitochen. The Medrash says a little earlier, Mikano Yo Rabbi Lozor Amidoy Yomei, Rabbi Lozor Amidoy used to say, Kol mi shiyesh lo ma yoichel hayoim v'yime ma oichel lemocho, hareze mechusur amon. Anybody who has what to eat today and worries about what he'll have to eat tomorrow is lacking emuna or lacking bitoch. Imagine what that means. A person's got what to eat today and worries about what he's going to eat tomorrow. So what kind of a situation is he in? He's in a situation where he's got a large family, and if he goes to his fridge, he's got a few eggs, and he's got a bottle of milk, and he's got some bread, and he's got a little bit of mincemeat, enough for a meal, and a couple of pieces of fruit. That's it. And his credit at the supermarket is up to the limit. His credit cards are all over the limit. His overdraft is all over the limit. His friends won't lend him any money. There is no way he can borrow another penny, and nor does he have food for tomorrow. Nothing. And he has little children, he has babies crying, nothing. And he has what to eat, and at supper time they finish the last piece of food. Now there's no milk left in the bottle, and there's no piece of meat left, there's no fruit left, there's no bread left, there's no money left, there's no credit line left. There's nothing. And he goes to sleep peacefully. He doesn't phone Joe Cohen to ask for a sleeping pill on credit. Nothing. Puts his head on his pillow and sleeps like a babe until the morning. That's bitochen. The person who worries about it is lacking bitochen. That's the definition. That's the level of bitochen that there has to be. How much more so when we're in a situation where we've got for tomorrow. Not only have we got for today, but we've got for tomorrow as well, and probably for the next day as well. For that you don't even need emunah and bitochen. That's easy to live that way. Where one has to live in a situation where you have literally just for the present. The future is, here we've got this definition of bitochen. When the future is truly doubtful, in fact bleak, and you're able to visualize continuity, that's bitochen. Not just that you're able to consider continuity, not just that you're able to think about the possibility of continuity, but you're able to visualize, you can see it there. That's bitochen. And in the long run, those are the people who do well. People who in times of depression can see the end of the depression. People when things are going down, they can already see them coming up again. And they're also the same people, by the way, when things are going up, they can see them coming down again. That's foresight, that's vision. When a person is able to look at things, not in terms of what's here right in the present, but is able to see the same degree of clarity when he looks into the future. He has a vision, he has a view. The view might be right, it might be wrong. Mostly it doesn't matter anymore whether it's right or wrong. He operates on the basis of that view and he makes it right. He builds it to it, towards it, he develops towards it. And that's what bitochen is. Bitochen is the ability to stand in the present with no real factual knowledge of the future. And yet, based on bitochen, to be able to visualize a future and to live according to that vision. That's bitochen. That's a completely different thing. And the example we had of it last night was Miriam. Where Miriam comes, after Moshe has finished his shiro, Miriam Hanavio and the ladies with her come out, But tupi muvim cholis, with musical instruments and bands and dancers, and they sing and they dance. And Rashi asks, where on earth did they get these musical instruments from? In the middle of the desert, just having crossed Yam Suf, where did they get it from? And Rashi says, Muftochos hayu tzadkoniyos shebedoyos HaKadosh Baruch Hu oseh lohem nisim v'tziyu tupim Mitzrayim. They were so sure that miracles would be done that they prepared the orchestra when they left Mitzrayim. They already got together, they gathered together an orchestra that they would be able to celebrate with when the Nisim took place. An unbelievable thing. In the midst of that sort of running away with nothing, running for their lives and running towards where? To the sea. They knew there was going to be sea there. How were they going to go anywhere? They didn't know what was going to happen. So why did they go? Because they could visualize the future already. But factually, scientifically, there was no future for this people. Where were they going? Wandering off into the desert, going towards some promised land which is over a sea, with power intent on their destruction. What economic future could there have been? What social future could there have been? What political future could there have been? No matter how you analyze the situation, it had to be totally bleak. And they went. What was it that drove them on? Bitochen. What does Bitochen mean? They saw Eretz Yisrael. They saw Har Sinai. They saw it all in front of them with such clarity that they even took the orchestra ready for that victory, ready for that celebration. And that's the way we have to live, certainly through difficult times. One can't look at the immediate future and see the bleakness and the blackness and try and make plans based on such a short-term vision. One can't. And people say, but how can one look long-term? It's very hard to look long-term. All we know is that those who look long-term will succeed, and those who look short-term will not succeed. One can't operate looking short-term. One has to see across the blackness, across the bleakness. One has to see the future, one has to see into that future, and one has to work towards that future. And that vision of the future, which is a function of bitochen, is the mechanism we use to release ourselves from the past. And release from the past is a vitally important process in the procedure of progress. For an individual to move forward, same as for an organization, but even for an individual to move forward, he's got to be able to get away from the past. He's got to be able to release himself. He uses the resources from the past, but the resources from the past have to be used to propel him into the future. And you cannot propel yourself into the future if you're hanging on to the past. Can't be done. Can't learn to swim if you're hanging on to the side. You can't learn to skate if you're hanging on to the rail. You've got to go. You've got to let go and move and take the risks. And you'll fall. Good, so you'll fall, but you'll get going. You'll get some water in your mouth. True, you'll sink a few times. Doesn't matter, but you'll get going. And before very long, you'll be swimming. And the only way you can do that is if you can visualize yourself swimming. Imagine you can't swim. You're hanging onto the side of the pool for dear life. And the swimming instructor says, right, now let go and swim. And you visualize sinking and drowning. You visualize having no oxygen. You visualize looking all over the place trying to find air. You're not going to be able to release. But if you visualize yourself swimming, you will release. That doesn't mean you'll swim straight away. That might mean you'll get a gulp of water. But very soon you will be swimming. And so it is with a skating example or with a skiing example, with all of them. If you visualize yourself succeeding, you'll let go. Once you've let go, you'll succeed. If you visualize yourself failing, you will not let go. If you don't let go, you'll always be hanging onto the side. And so the world is made up of those of us who are hanging onto the side and those of us who are skating around having a good time. And the mechanism of that release is that which enables us to visualize the success is bitochen. That's what does it. It has to be one of two things. Either it's an enormous sense of self-esteem and self-confidence, or it's bitochen. You either believe that I can do anything, which is the way the motivationalists try to motivate people, and that works very well until the person starts getting a little bit older and finds that he can't do anything, everything. It's alright, for younger people that's fine. The motivationists say, anything you believe you can do now. Just believe you can do it and you'll do it. And people try it and it works and it works and it works, but then comes a time when it doesn't work. And then the whole system falls to pieces. And the fellow cracks up, and he loses self-confidence, and he loses self-esteem, and he becomes demotivated and depressed. What's happened? He's been taught sheker. His motivational system has been structured on something which is untrue. But bitochen is not untrue. To be able to say, I'm sure in my own mind that what I'm about to do is the right thing for me to do, and therefore that the Ribbono Shel Olam will help me succeed, that's not sheker. Then you can visualize the success not built on an exaggerated sense of self-esteem, but built on a belief in my own worth, together with a belief in the worthwhileness of what I'm doing, and a belief in the Ribbono Shel Olam's ability and desire to help me succeed. And with that, one can move forward. If that's the case, we have a bit of a difficulty further on, where Bnei Yisrael are criticized for exactly the opposite. There's a time a little further on when they move off from camp rather hastily, and they're accused, that's after Har Sinai, they're sitting at the mountain, the Torah's been given already, it's all over, Moshe's come down, and it's time to go. And we know they never moved until they were told to move, until the pillar of cloud or the pillar of fire moved, they never began to move, so certainly they didn't move any quicker than they were instructed to do. And yet the Medrash Tanchuma says there in Bahaloisach also that they moved Ketino Kabureach Mibes HaSefer. They left Har Sinai like a child leaves school. Now based on what we've just said, so what's wrong with that? One has to be able to release oneself from the past. It was lovely to be at Har Sinai, but there's a job to do. We've got to get to Eretz Yisrael. Time to go. Why not be enthusiastic about the move forward? If our principle is right that we use the visualization of the future and we use the middle of Bitochin to release ourselves from hanging onto the rail and to allow ourselves to move forward, what was so terrible about the fact that Bnei Yisrael left Har Sinai with a bit of enthusiastic excitement? And they're criticized for leaving it as in the same way as a child runs away from school. What's so terrible about that? To understand that, we need to go a little further in our parsha. What happens after Moshe gets them away from leaving all this beautiful gold and silver and precious stones behind? Vayetzu el Midbar Shur, they went out into Midbar Shur, Vayelchu Shloshes Yomim, they walked for 3 days, by Midbar in the desert, Veloy Motsu Moim, and they could find no water. Vayavoyo Moroso, and they came to Moro, Veloy Yochlu Lishtois Maim, Mimoro, and they were unable to drink the water from Moro, Ki Morim Heim, for the waters were bitter. Alkein Koroshmo Moro, and that's why it was called Moro. Vayiloinu Ho'om al Moshe Leimor, and the nation complained to Moshe, saying, Ma nishteh, what are we going to drink? Vayitzak el Hashem, and Moshe cried out to Hashem, Vayureyu Hashem eitz, and Hashem showed him a tree, Vayashlech el Hamayim, and he threw it into the water, Vayimtuku Hamoyim, and the water became sweet. Shom som loichoyku mishpot, v'shom nisom. What's that episode got to do with it all? The first thing we see from there is a lesson that all that money that they collected, that all that wealth which they accumulated, both in Mitzrayim before they departed and at the side of the sea only 3 days earlier, was insufficient to be able to buy them a glass of water. And that wealth, or the pursuit of wealth, is an attempt to find security and happiness in external objects. To believe that there is something outside of me that can make me happy. Thirst teaches us exactly the opposite. That what I'm suffering from is a vacuum inside me. There's something I'm missing inside me. And nothing external can satisfy that, except water, which doesn't cost anything. You've either got it or you don't have it. You can't buy it. And a realization that the most important things in life don't cost money. That the things that really are most critical for our happiness don't cost money. The things that can make us most uncomfortable can't be avoided with money. And the things that can bring us a great deal of satisfaction and relief also very often don't cost money. Happiness doesn't cost money. And no amount of money can make somebody happy. Money can make somebody comfortable, but money can't make somebody happy. And we need to train ourselves to perceive and to live by an understanding of the difference between comfort and happiness. Sure, we all like to be comfortable. There's nothing wrong with being comfortable. There's nothing wrong with trying to be comfortable. The problem arises when we start confusing comfort with happiness, when we think that if we're comfortable, we will be happy. That's not so. And that if we're uncomfortable, we will be unhappy. That's also not so. The two have nothing to do with each other. One can have one's greatest moments of happiness at times of great discomfort, and one can have periods of enormous comfort when one is very unhappy. And the two don't affect one another at all necessarily. And that was the lesson that they were being taught right here. You were willing to come to Har Sinai later in order to collect a little bit more silver and gold. And you thought by doing so you were establishing a security, you were building something which would lend security, which would give you happiness. Now what? You've got all the gold and silver. All you want is water, and there's water there, you just can't drink it. Try with your money. Your money can't help you either. Because when your discomfort, when your unhappiness is caused by an inadequacy inside of you, nothing external can solve that. That's something you have to solve yourself. There are two views in Chazal. One is the straightforward view that they were thirsty. The Tanchuma brings the Dorshei Rishumos Omru Lefi Shepirshu Midivrei Toiro Shenim Shulu Lamayim. It means in addition to the physical thirst, the Torah is also teaching us about a spiritual thirst. The Torah is referred to as water very often. And when it says that for 3 days they went and they hadn't found water, that means that they hadn't learned Torah for 3 days and they were experiencing that thirst. That's why Kriyas HaTorah was instituted on Mondays and Thursdays, so that no 3 days should go by that a person wouldn't hear Torah. Even if he's not learning, even if he doesn't come to a shir, but at least we know for sure he'll be exposed to Torah in gaps of less than 3 days. 3 days won't go past without him hearing Torah. Because the effect on the soul of not being exposed to Torah is the same as the effect on the body not being exposed to water. There's a thirst, there's an internal craving which can't be satisfied by anything else. And that's how the Medrash Tanchuma learns this, one of the ways that the Medrash Tanchuma learns this. And that's why at Moro not only were they given water, but Shom Som Loi Choyku Mishpot, there also the Ribbono Shlom taught them some of the halachas. Moshe Rabbeinu taught them the halachas of Shabbos, certain mishpotim, certain chukim, kibud av ve'em. They were actually taught Torah there. That's what they needed. They were thirsty not only for water, they were thirsty for Torah as well. But interesting to see is the way that the bitter waters are made sweet. A tree is thrown into them. And the tree that is thrown is in fact a bitter tree. The Medrash Tanchuma says, "Ata meitze boso v'dom." Ribbono Shalom is unlike human beings. He uses the disease with which he strikes to also be the cure. Now I suppose we understand that a little bit better with things like vaccinations and so on, where there is such a concept even in medicine of curing a disease with the disease itself. You'll see an example of this in Moro. They were unable to drink the water from Moro. What did Moshe think when he turned to Hashem in prayer? What did he expect? He thought that God would miraculously show him a source of honey or of figs or something else sweet, and he would tell Moshe to put the sweet things into the water and that would sweeten the water. What's it written? Moshe cried to Hashem. Vayorehu Hashem etz. Vayorehu is an interesting word. Vayorehu Hashem etz means Hashem taught him about the tree. It doesn't just mean that he showed him a tree. It's not vayarehu. He showed him. Vayorehu comes from meire, from Torah. He taught him the Torah of the tree. What was that? Omar le HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Moshe, ein darki kemidas boso v'dom. My way is not like the human way. I don't work scientifically. Boso v'dom, achshav ato tzorich lilmud. Now you've got to learn it. What was the tree, says the Tanchuma? So there are different versions as to what the tree was. But at the end of it, the Tanchuma says, in any event, according to all the versions, whether it was an olive tree or some other tree, it was all a bitter sort of a wood. So how does it work that you put a negative into a negative, something bitter into something bitter? It comes out a miracle. Hashem said to Moshe, I do it that way. I heal with the very thing that I cause the disease. Since this water is bitter, I will improve it with bitterness. What's the Medrash trying to teach us? It's a bitter tree, put it into bitter water. Sometimes there is a bitterness due not to any inherent fault. A person is bitter sometimes not because there's anything wrong with him, but because a dynamic isn't taking place. He's not operating, he's not being creative. He becomes bitter. It doesn't help to sweeten him. A person is uncreative, he gets depressed. In some form or another. When one's depressed, one gets miserable and bitter. And it doesn't help sweetening such a person up. There's nothing you can do to sweeten the person up. That just covers it up. That's like putting wallpaper over the cracks. You don't really achieve anything. You don't solve anything. Sometimes you'll find a bitter old bachelor and a bitter old spinster and you make a shidduch, and they're fine afterwards. The bitterness is gone. What does that mean? Where did the bitterness go to? He was bitter, she was bitter, miserable species. And you put them together and they're unrecognizable. They've changed all together. He's lived all his life alone. She's lived all his life alone. He was selfish. She was selfish. Put them together, they become generous, outward people. What's happened? Just the dynamic has started to take place. Each one was bitter not because he was inherently or she was inherently bitter, but because he lacked the other in order to create the correct dynamics which would relieve the bitterness. The water's bitter. The tree is bitter. Put them together and you've got sweetness. What did we say? The water was compared to Torah. And what about the tree? We say, Ki ha'odom etz ha'sodeh, the tree is compared to the man. Torah without the human being can be bitter. What does it mean that Torah without the human being can be bitter? What is water without trees? If you have a pool of water but no greenery, the water may become stagnant. The greenery is what causes the circulation. The water is sucked into the trees. It nourishes the trees. It evaporates from the leaves of the trees. It becomes water vapor in the atmosphere. Clouds form. Rain comes down. And the circular motion of water takes place. There's a dynamic. If there's no green there, the water is stagnant. The water stands still. The dynamic doesn't take place. Man is what makes the Torah dynamic. The Torah without man is pure, but it's not dynamic. It's not developing, it's not moving, it's not adapting. It's undynamic Torah. And in that sense, it's bitter, it's difficult to integrate it, it's difficult to digest it. It's difficult to enjoy it when it's sterile, when it's stagnant, one doesn't like to use such a word with Torah, but one can, because it can happen sometimes. Torah can be boring. If you take undynamic Torah, it's boring. And there are certain aspects of Torah which are very hard to learn. To learn dinim, for example, is very difficult. Just dry dinim. Open a list of laws. You may do this, you may not do this, you may do this, you may not do this. It's Torah. But it's terribly boring. You can only do it for a few minutes before you fall asleep. To learn Mishnah, unless one's learning it very cleverly or one is being taught it very cleverly, it is so concentrated. It is so undynamic in itself. It's so dry that it's very boring. Gemara is not boring. Why is Gemara not boring? Because it's dynamic. Gemara is the process of the human being applying his mind to the Torah. And the give and take, and the dialogue, and the questioning, and the answering. Gemara is when Torah becomes dynamic. And that's when it starts operating. What about a human being without Torah? He also gets bitter. A human being without Torah is also undynamic. He's also not creative. He's also not productive. He's also not developing. He also becomes embittered. So you can have a man who's not applying his mind to the Torah becomes bitter. You can have Torah that is having no human being apply his dynamic intellect to it. It becomes bitter. Put the two together and you've got an explosion of creative might. The Torah and the human intellect come together and it produces something powerful. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted to teach Klal Yisrael. That can't be gotten with money. That you can't get by standing at Yam Suf collecting the gold and the silver and the precious stones. That's not going to give you dynamics. That's not going to satisfy your inner urges. That's not going to make you feel fulfilled no matter how much you have of it. You're still going to get depressed. You're still going to get miserable. You're still going to feel unfulfilled and unsatisfied. All you need is to take the tree, which is the human being, bitter. Throw it into the water, which is the Torah, also bitter. It's bitter not just because it's sterile without the human mind, but it's also bitter because when you start off, it's hard. You start learning a piece of Torah, you start learning a piece of Gemara for the first time. It's difficult, and it's not rewarding. It takes hours before it becomes rewarding. You've got to acknowledge that you're applying yourself to something which is initially bitter. And it's through the bitterness will be created that sweetness. But one has to persist, and one has to apply one's mind to it, and go through the bitter phase in order to come to the sweetness. And then there can be fulfillment, and then there can be that creative drive. That's what they needed to appreciate. The Medrash says, the Medrash Rabbah in Vayakhel, I think it is Parshah Nun, comments also on this part, on Maro, and it says, Rabbi Levi says there, Hadir Hahu, that generation was Mar B'Ma'asov. It's not just the water that was bitter. They were bitter. And it's clear in the Pasuk also that it is so. As it says, firstly, Vayavoyu Moroso, and they came to Moro, Velo Yochlu Lishtos Mayim Mimoro, and they were unable to drink water from Moro, Ki Morim Heim, which could mean because the water was bitter, and it could mean because they were bitter. Sometimes you can't learn Torah when you're bitter. There was an imperfection, there was a flaw in the people. And why were they bitter? Because they'd gone 3 days without Torah, they became bitter. And then it's a vicious circle. You've gone 3 days without Torah, you become thirsty. That thirsty makes you irritable and makes you embittered. That bitterness makes it impossible, and then it starts by Yiloinu. They start complaining. They're not criticized for asking for water. They're criticized for the Vayiloinu, for the complaining way in which they ask for it. There is a difference between the way an embittered person asks for something and the way a dynamic person asks for something. When a dynamic person, when a person who is himself full and creative and dynamic asks for something, it's a pleasure to respond. Because there's energy, there's electricity in the request. And in the fulfillment of the request, there's even more electricity. When an embittered person, when an empty person asks for something, it's a drag to respond. A terrible drag. It's like dropping a stone into a well of water. You drop the stone and you listen and you hear the ping when it hits the water, and it's nice, you hear some feedback. But if you drop a stone into a well that has no water at the bottom, or the water is so deep that you can't hear it, you don't hear anything. There's no echo. Nothing comes back to you. There is no dynamic. There is no give and take. When an empty person asks for something, it's a nudnik, it's a nag, it's vayiloinu. That's what they criticized, for nagging for water, not for asking for water. Nothing wrong with asking for water, for nagging for water. And why did they nag? Because they were empty. Why were they empty? 3 days without Torah. The most terrible time for me is January. Because January in the Beis HaMedrash comes after a period of holiday. And the holiday, December, comes after a very busy time. People are busy in November, and they're busy in December, they're busy in October already. There was Yom Tov, and then it's end of the year, and then people are planning the holidays. So Lamaisa, what happens is that the learning is of an inadequate level for some 3 months, October, November, December, part of January, three and a half months, the learning is inadequate. And when people haven't been learning well for 3 months, they become misleinonim. They're not a question of demanding better things. People who are active demanding better things, that's fine, that's one thing. A person who's learning well and wants to learn still better, that's a pleasure, that's dynamic, that's exciting. But when people are not learning well and they're complaining, that's misleinonim, that's a different kind of thing altogether. And the only thing that keeps me going every January is I think it's a wonderful thing. At least it shows this thirst. It shows that people take a suffer when there's no learning. That's wonderful. They don't maybe even realize it themselves, but it shows that they're suffering. That the effects, the symptoms are the same as when people have been without water. What happens when people are without water? They get irritable. And they speak in an unkind way. And they relate to people in an irritated sort of way. They can't help it. They are irritated. And that's the same effect when one's been without learning. One becomes irritable and one irritates. And that's a wonderful thing to see, in fact, that when people haven't been learning, they taka show the same symptoms as people who haven't been drinking. They're parched, they're miserable, they're frustrated, they're nagging. It's terrible. You know what it is with children also. Children come, they've been playing outside, or they've gone for a long walk, and they come back and they haven't been drinking, and they're nudgy. And you give them something to drink, all of a sudden they're fine, off they go and they play. So what are they nudging about? They don't nudge for water. They nudge for all sorts of things. They nudge about their friends, and they nudge about their parents, and they nudge all sorts of things they're arguing about, and they're nagging about. You give them some water to drink, and all of a sudden they go off, they're playing, they've forgotten about their friends, and they forgot. All the things they were nagging about are no longer issues. Because that isn't what they were nagging about. They were irritable. They were irritable because they're thirsty. And we need to know that we become irritable when our learning is not good. When our learning suffers, when we're not thinking creatively, when we're not acting creatively, when we're not involved in Torah in a creative way, inevitably we become irritable. And that irritability affects those around us too. It's inevitable. It's something which happens to anybody who has been involved in learning. If one's never been involved in learning, one becomes immune to thirst. But if one has not become immune to thirst, if one knows what it is to drink water, when one is deprived of that water, one feels it. And so now let us go back to the statement of the Tanchuma that when they left Har Sinai, they left in too much of a rush. And we asked, so what? What's wrong with that? We said you've got to be able to release the past, and you release the past by visualizing the future. So when they left Har Sinai, it's enough already. They'd been at Har Sinai a long time. They'd got the Torah. It was now finished and over with. Time to work towards the future. The future's Eretz Israel. Surely there's nothing wrong with that. And the Chazal say that it was ketinu kabureach mibeis ha-sefer, like a child runs away from school. What's wrong with a child running away from school? It's the same thing. School's over. It's been at school for a long day. Now he must look towards the future. The future's going home, playing, doing what he has to do, getting to his other activities. There's nothing wrong in releasing the past and moving towards the future. But one needs to understand the difference in this approach between the Har Sinai experience and the Yam Suf experience. When your security is the handrail on the ice rink, or the edge of the swimming pool, when it's a physical thing, that's something which holds you back. And one has to be able to release it in order to go on. But when the thing you've experienced has been an internal experience, that's not something you can run away from. It's something that comes with you. What is strange, what's peculiar about a tinuk habereach mibeis hasefer, a child who runs away from school, is what's he running away from? What he's got, what he got during that day goes with him. You can't leave it behind. If you run away from the gold and the silver and the diamonds and the jewels on the side of the sea, when you run away, you are in fact running away from something, and that from which you're running remains behind, and you go off without it. And that's why it's difficult. But when you leave school, you're going off with nothing. You're leaving nothing behind. Whatever you got there, you're taking with you. Whatever there was there, you're taking with you. You're not leaving anything behind. The school is not the building. The school was the learning, the knowledge. And the knowledge you've got inside you already. That's a different thing. There's no point in running. That's not a time at which one has to leave aside one's past. Because learning is not a past. Learning is always with us. Learning is the present. Always the present. Always the present. Because learning is eternal. And when they left Har Sinai, that was something that, so to say, appears to have escaped them. On whatever level we understand that. But they thought, now we've got to move away from Har Sinai. There is no moving away from Har Sinai. There's no such thing as moving away from Har Sinai. Har Sinai comes with you wherever you go for the rest of your history. It will never leave you behind, and you will never leave it behind. So this image of moving away from something which cannot be moved away from is what they're criticized for. To see the experience of Har Sinai as one point in their career which can then be passed, that doesn't take place. To see learning Torah as a point in one's day, which one does and then leaves behind and goes on to other things, that's an artificial perception. There's no such thing. Yes, you leave your business behind and go on to other things. Yes, you leave your leisure activities behind and you go on to other things. You leave your meal behind and you go on to other things. You leave all sorts of things behind in order to go on to other things. But you don't leave Torah behind in order to go on to other things. Torah is the one thing that you take with you into your future. You don't leave that behind. It's not necessary to sever your contact with your Torah past in order to move into the future. On the contrary, you cannot move into the future having severed your connection to the Torah past. That is the source of all the energy that drives you into the future, and that has to come with you. And so they had it the wrong way around. And that's the interesting contrast between these two words. When they were leaving the sides of Yam Suf with all that gold and silver and diamonds, there they should have gone themselves. They should have realized it's time to move on. We've got a future. We've got Har Sinai. We've got Matan Torah. We've got Eretz Yisrael. We have things which are much more valuable than this gold and silver. This gold and silver can't buy us happiness. This gold and silver can't buy us knowledge. It can't buy us fulfillment. It can't buy us any of the things that are really important. And in order to collect more of it, we would have to sacrifice the things that are really important. It's waiting for us. The Har Sinai is waiting for us. And that is what we're going to get at Har Sinai, will be able to give us happiness, will be able to give us fulfillment and satisfaction. So clearly we must move on to the future. That's how it should have been. But it wasn't. They had to be motivated to leave Yam Suf to move towards Har Sinai. When they came to Har Sinai, there should have been no rush to leave. Because they should have not have seen their presence at Sinai as any kind of conflict to the future to which they were working towards. On the contrary, the longer they're at Sinai, the longer they're involved in Torah, the more equipped they are becoming to face that future and to invest in that future and to develop that future. And that really is the essence of bitochen and part of the art of living, is that sense of understanding the relationship of the present to the past and to the future. Of understanding that sometimes the present that we're involved in is already part of the future. And to understand sometimes that the past that one has been involved in is part of that future. When the past that we've been involved in is secure to us because of its physical security, we know it's time to move on. When we start feeling too comfortable with the past, when we start feeling too at home and too secure with the past, it's time to make a move, it's time to move on, it's time to develop into new areas. This is, by the way, an important area, and people don't realize enough of it, in career development. Most people look at their careers in terms of what am I doing for my career. And if I look at it in terms of what am I doing for my career path will have to be one of long-term stability. So if I go and I work for the bank and I'm always asking myself only what am I going to be doing for the bank and for my career with the bank, then I've got to work out, start serving the tea, become a teller, go up, become a sub-manager and a manager and a branch manager and an area manager. That's the way I can advance my career with a bank most of all. But one sometimes has to look at a career differently, and one has to say, that's what's important, because my career is really there to serve me, not the other way around. I'm doing the job because I'm supposed to be progressing, developing, growing. And although one might find from a purely material point of view, we're not talking from a purely material point of view, the best thing might be to stay where one is for one's entire life. But it's not necessarily the best thing to do for one's own self-fulfillment and for the development of one's talents and for the development of one's ability. One has to be able to realize that one has grown into new areas which now need to be developed. One is ready to say goodbye to something which now enables one to propel oneself into new areas, which very often doesn't mean giving up what one has done, but changing the emphasis. That one can find a new hobby that becomes very important to one. One finds within one's work new areas in which to emphasize, in which to concentrate. At one stage one was concentrating on the financial side and one's grown out of that. One now wants to work in the marketing side or vice versa. Even within that career structure, to be able to realize that there come points where it's no longer doing anything for you. It's all very well that you're doing something for your company or you're doing something for your profession. That's all fine. But you've got to keep on asking yourself, am I growing? Am I developing? Am I finding new horizons to conquer, to work towards? Am I stretching myself in new directions? That's what has to be asked constantly. And one has to find that as one progresses down that career path, whether it's within one organization or it's not within one organization, whether it's finding additional things with which to cope, or whether it's finding alternative things with which to cope, there has to be that continual new challenge. And the terrible danger is that that comfort that one finds in doing the things one knows how to do best is so tempting that one loses the drive to be willing to move out into areas which are less familiar and to tackle and to struggle with issues that one's never struggled with before and that one's never tackled before. But if one doesn't do that, one stagnates. And it's the same in one's learning. One has to tackle new areas, one has to get onto new areas, one has to try new things, one has to experience new dimensions within one's learning of Torah. It's within one's intellectual development. One has to read new things that one hasn't read before. Study new things that one hasn't studied before. Experience new things that one hasn't experienced before. One has to move out into these areas and grow and develop. One can't become stuck in a rut and stuck in a routine because that's where one feels comfortable. Unless one moves into this area, there is no growth and there is no development. Each person has to find where those areas are going to take place and where he's going to find himself able to design for himself a new horizon to tackle. And one needs that vision in order to do that. In order to realize that it's a move forward, one needs to be able to visualize precisely where it is to which I'm moving, what it is to which I'm moving. To be able to see that with a clarity that is no less than the clarity with which one can view one's past. And the clarity of the future is a function of bitochen. To be able to see the future, clearly one needs an element of bitochen. With that bitochen and with that clarity of the future, one's willing to move away from the past a lot more easily. However, when it comes to spiritual things, when it comes to Torah itself, there one has to realize that you can never leave that behind in order to move into the future. One leaves one's Torah behind in order to move into the future, there is no future. Torah, as it was at Har Sinai, that's a different thing altogether. That's a source of energy. And that source of energy needs to be remained plugged into it continuously and continually in order to move forward. So the physical things one needs to sever oneself from in order to float into the future. The spiritual things one needs to attach oneself to in order to float into the future. And that combination of spiritually attaching ourselves to the past and materially releasing ourselves from the past creates the dynamics of a life developed towards progress.